to the main event. Let's get ready to rumble!
Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is the Insurgent Radio Network. And this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker, right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse and Filling Station.
You're damn tootin' right. It's time to get ready to rumble, man, and we're going to rumble a little bit today. This is Terrible Tommy, and don't forget, spread the word on that subscribing to our radio show and tell them they can spend $20 with Terrible Tommy, or they can waste a hell of a lot more money on nonsense and reactionary bullshit. So it's your choice. Yeah, and quite a few of you have made the right choice. Yeah, P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana 46581. Beautiful day here in the Midwest. Beautiful day on September the 18th, 2014. My gosh, my Thor, this month is flying by, and now it's Thursday. We got a half moon out there. And we got beautiful weather, but from what I hear from my kids out on the West Coast, they're dying out there of heat, man. They're getting baked, yeah. Well, as you know, I don't give the cops much of a break. And I know there's people out there, some of our friends, who are a little bit more pro-cop than I have, but I guess a lot of you people haven't been beaten over the head or seen friends beaten to half to death or seen dogs unleashed on peaceful people and all the stuff that goes along with it. And you haven't probably experienced the amount of lying I've experienced from cops, not only from Southern California, but up Portland, Oregon, and it would take a book to explain all of that stuff. So don't be too excited when I criticize cops. The first thing you got to know is cops are not directly paid by us, even though they are paid by us. the bottom they're going to serve whoever's name is on the bottom line of their check, and that's not you, even though it should be classed as you. So you have very little control over cops unless there's a major, major upset in the community. And then sometimes the timid little white rabbits will come out to a public meeting and raise hell about the cops. Not near. I'm more happy with the Negroes, the way they handle it. When something happens in their community they don't like and the cops are behind it, they go down there and raise hell, man. And I respect them for it. Here is a email from one of our supporters and associates that I think is a little bit different. Cops are merely employees who are compelled to do the bidding of their employers. Well, if they don't like it enough, they can quit. There's a lot of other jobs in this world besides being a cop. If a cop's supervisors demand a complete unbiased investigation, then that's what you will get. And if their supervisors demand an investigation be cut short, then likewise you will get the same. If they did anything other than that, they would not remain cops too long. In other words, cops are manipulated all the time by their supervisors. And but how many of you read anything in the newspapers about regular cops banding together to keep their supervisors honest? It's sort of like that, sticking together, and it's blue, and everybody else is black and white and brown, but they're blue, or like the Marine Corps or something like that. That's that camaraderie. You should never criticize your group. Police departments are driven largely by local politics. True. The politics determine what the supervisors demand, and the cops, as the low-level employees, are compelled, if they wish to retain their jobs, to comply. Well, I understand the pecking order, but that doesn't mean that honest cops shouldn't resist illegal and bad instructions. You need to stop taking things so personally. Well, personally, the reason I take it personally, because I've had it all happen to me. I got the scars to prove it. And in the end, I lost a house because of it. I lost a business because of it. Because the cops in Portland knew exactly what happened in that case up there. And they knew it was total bullshit what was going on in court. But they did not lift one finger to testify when I subpoenaed them. They got on the stand, they hudged, they fudged, and outright lied. So I do take it personally what cops do, and everybody else should too, because they have powers that you don't have legally. In the end, we will need sympathizers among both the police, government, and military, or we will fail. Well, we have sympathizers in there. Don't you understand that? We've had lone wolves in the police departments for a long time, but they're not coming out and talking about it, and they're not talking about race, and they're not going out and stupidly joining the Ku Klux Klan. We're not talking about those people. Those people know how we feel, and they're doing a good job behind the scenes, and will do a lot better job in the future when they're needed even more. So when I talk about cops, I'm not talking about the ones that are our friends or will be our friends or should be our friends. I'm talking about the ones that are too far gone to be our friends. When you make statements like this, you publicly immeasurably damage the ability to maintain those sympathizers and the ability to recruit new ones. No, I don't think so. Because the ones that are underground and quiet, I know what they're thinking, and they know what I'm thinking. And they know I'm right. Keep your mouth shut, do your job, and do what you can to help the white people, the ones who deserve it. And don't reveal yourself. If people don't understand that, I don't know how I can explain it any clearer. I'm not going to come out here and say, well, I got Joe Blow over here. He's a cop. He's our best friend, man. And he's even got a Support Tom Metzger bumper sticker on his car. Come on, give me a break. One wants to be sympathetic to a cause. No one wants to be sympathetic to a cause that continually attacks and belittles them. Well, let me see here. I got to move this down here so I can read it a little better. I don't call it belittling them just to call them out when they are goons and when they do illegal acts against the people, unconstitutional acts against the people. That's not belittling them. They belittle themselves. Our people should never expect police to publicly support or defend us in the first place. Well, of course not. I've been preaching that for 30 years, 35 years. That's just not possible in the current political climate in this country. We shouldn't trust the police because it's impossible to sort out for sure who will be faithful to us or their employees, but neither should we continually bash and degenerate them. Well, I don't. I don't spend that much time attacking cops on here. So, impossible to sort out? Of course it's impossible to sort out. But that's the way this kind of struggle is. It's an unconventional warfare. And in unconventional warfare, those are the problems you have. You don't know for sure who's your friend and who's not. but you're surely not going to front anybody off if you find out they are a supporter and you try to get across to them to keep their mouths shut and don't say anything racial on a job at all and don't have any kind of racial material around your house or in your car or anything like that. In fact, pretend to be on the other side. That's what I've told cops for years. I'll tell you one thing, when I have talked to the sheriff a couple of times in this county, he's been extremely friendly to me and helped me out on a couple of road problems I had and like that. I have not had problems with a lot of local cops, even down in Southern California. In fact, the local cops, sheriffs down there, when Irv Rubin said he was coming to town to get Tom Metzger, the sheriffs told him over the phone, he said, "You better not come down here. You're going to have a lot more trouble than Tom Metzger." So don't be so strict and literal about things. You got to read between the lines out there. This struggle, like all struggles, is about winning the hearts and minds. And you simply cannot win the hearts and minds of any government workers if you continually publicly condemn them. Human nature just doesn't work that way. Well, I'm not trying to convince the masses anyhow. The masses are asses, and you're not going to convince them either. I'm not out to be buddy-buddy and friends with anybody that's in government or anyplace else. I'm going to say it the way it needs to be said. And if cops are treating the public badly, and if they disobey the basic rules of order, and if they become if they're law enforcement instead of peacekeepers, then if they get brutalized, well, that's their problem. This struggle, like all struggles, is about winning the hearts and minds. Oh, I already read that. Well, I'm not out to be lovey-dovey with anybody. I think worse is better. When the non-whites want to attack the cops, well, big deal. I've been on the streets when the cops were attacking me, endangering my life, endangering the lives of my friends. I've been down that road, so don't tell me about this, and don't tell me about all these nice cops. If there are good cops in there, they're being good cops. That's fine. Whatever a good cop is, and if we've got friends in the inside, they're keeping their mouths shut. We won't know who they are. I don't want to know who they are. But I'm not going to lay off the cops totally. I mean, you know, I'm going to because they're part of the system. The system is our enemy, and they are at the sort of the bottom of the loop. But that's too bad. If you can't handle it, get out of it, you know. Become a preacher or an evangelist or a missionary to Yabunga. You know, I get in a lot of trouble for some of the things I say. Not really, but I have to get it across the hard way, because I don't know of anybody else doing it. Or they all want to buddy up to the system. The system is killing us. The police forces who have killed and assassinated several of my friends. So don't expect me to be Mr. Lovey-Dovey of the cops. But don't expect me to say that all cops are bad either, and not all and some cops are with us, and we know that, and they know that, and they don't need reassuring because I've told them so. But your criticism is welcomed, and I understand where it's coming from, and we'll go from there. White men and the loss of jobs are another issue that gripes my ass. Tom Kaminsky is back at work 3 years after losing his job as the human resource manager and dropping out of the labor force for a time to go to college. Now, I don't think we need the human resource managers anyhow. Kaminsky, 43, dipped into his retirement savings while he earned a master's degree. The added credential helped him land the position at the Intuitive HR LLC, a consulting company in Woodbridge, Connecticut, last September, which is probably another bunch of bullshit. "It was always my goal to come back to work," he said. "I thought I was a very good human resource person, and I thought I had a lot more to achieve." Too few men like Kaminsky are returning to work in a decades-long puzzle about the prime working age males ages 25 to 54 falling away from the U.S. labor force. Well, they can't find jobs, and they won't fight for jobs, and they vote against any kind of collective bargaining, and they vote for right to starve laws. Their participation rate slid to 88.4% in August in a steady decline from 97.9% in 54. Over the last 10 years, the slump was steep for those ages 25 to 34. Well, if you won't fight, if you won't go into the streets, if you won't kick ass like Stallone did in Fist, if you won't do something and you just cry like they cry, "Oh, poor me. And you go out and vote for these goddamn property party Republicans and warmongers every time. Not that the Democrats are much better. About 7 million male Americans waste the best years of wealth formation not employed or even trying to find work. The pattern will persist, economists say, putting some men, particularly those without a college degree, at risk of a permanent isolation from the job market. Oh, I want a job. Sometimes you have to get up on your back feet and back cockles or whatever you want to call it and fight for the job. Fight these goddamn niggers and Mexicans for the jobs. Let them know you got some muscle like the boys used to be. You know, they used to pick up a baseball bat and go down and say, "Hey, you're not taking our jobs, assholes," and beat the shit out of them. What do the white Americans do today? White males? They cry. "Oh, isn't it too bad? Too bad, you know, too bad." I don't sympathize with you. If you won't fight for yourself and fight for your jobs and fight for your future, then what can I do for you? I can do nothing for you at all. End of story. Now, some of the right-wingers have been running a thread on the Internet. They've been sending it to me about this idea of forming another big organization, another big tent, which I poo-poo. And, of course, because you know what's going to happen. I mean, same old shit, different day. I mean, you know, there's certain major domos that are in the right wing and running the right wing, I guess, if they're running anything, and they all want to be at the top giving their fancy "I hate the Jews" speeches. Let's get the niggers, even though I ain't got a candy's ass chance in hell of doing it because I'm a cowardly son of a bitch. Anyhow, and they're not all these people are bad, don't get me wrong, but I get pissed. This is Thursday. I'm warming up to the weekend. I'm pissed. So anyhow, I sent back to them, "As you may understand, the blacks or the mestizos or whoever are not the main problem. The problem is the lack of reaction among the white general public. And you're not going to sweet talk them. Pretty please, will you fight for your race and your future and your lives and your daughters and all that? Will you do that, please? Please? Get out of here, you goddamn racist. I'm calling the cops." That makes a large percentage of the white race an enemy to white survival, too. In fact, there is more threat to the white race within the white race today than from any other group. The right continues to use the wrong tactics. Blacks and others' attacks on whites should not be interfered with. You heard me. Should not be interfered with. You're going down the street and you see some nigger boy beating on a white prostitute or whatever. Don't you dare interfere. We've had a lot of guys do that. A lot of guys ended up in prison for trying to help somebody. Okay, let's see here. I always get my recorder in the way of my work. How am I going to do this? Okay, this is ridiculous. Oh, I'm still on here. I thought I put it on mute. Okay. The blacks and others, attacks on whites should not be interfered with. In some cases, it should even be encouraged. For whites that are hopelessly beyond the pale. Only if some animals are cornered with nowhere to go will they react violently or die. Either way is okay. Even though it's tough to see this anti-white violence, it's our only card that has a hope of winning in the long run. I spent 9 years in the John Birch Society, or we used to laughingly call it the Birch-John Society. The leader, Robert Welch, was able to divert serious pro-white action and Jew criticism by simply labeling those that were fighting for the race, attacking the Jew power, as com simps, that's C-O-M-S-Y-M-P-S. In his pamphlet called The Neutralizers, wait a minute here. In his pamphlet called The Neutralizers, all of those fighting for the race, especially in the South, were labeled as people who helped the communist cause. In other words, you must be a communist. You want to stop the niggers from taking over and destroying your schools and destroying your culture, destroying your race. You must be a communist. Or the same way with criticizing the Jews in Israel. Oh, that's helping the communist cause. That's what they used to pitch. As a unit leader in Southern California, I was directed to expel anyone that attacked Jews or blacks at the meetings. Even though in reality, a whole lot of people in the John Birch Society were racist to the core, but they had to keep it quiet. I resigned, even though the JBS was full of quiet racists and anti-Jews. I call my method Jiu-Jitsu. Turn the power of the enemy back on them by saying, I don't care, and worse is better. Post-black propaganda inciting blacks against mestizos and vice versa. We did some of this in Southern California. Simple example. The Black Revolution invites Latino women to a Saturday night dance in the ghetto. Whatever that address you want to dream up. You get the idea. Using reverse logic is a great tactic. In fact, it's the only tactic we can use now. Reactionary tactics fail completely. That's why the right wing doesn't go anywhere. They use reactionary tactics, thinking they're going to recruit the masses. The masses are asses. There is no need to go to prison if you want temporary racial chaos. I know there's people out there that disagree with me about chaos, but chaos can be a path to something else. In between the time a revolution wins, and it hasn't started yet, is a period of chaos. And it's up to you how you handle chaos. Example, don't support the cops in Ferguson situations. Say the black community has a natural right to self-determination. Don't side with system cops. And like I just read this critique of what I'm saying about cops, if a cop is on our side, he knows what unconventional warfare is and how to operate underground, keep his mouth shut, don't go to any so-called right-wing meetings or anything like that. If you need to, pretend to be of the different thinking. Pretend to be a progressive. I know that. They know that. Now you know that. You have nothing to gain. They support the property party, i.e. the wealthy class. And what has that class done to deserve to live? What have they done for working class whites lately? When the Rodney King riots occurred, the press kept calling me about what I thought. They didn't get what they wanted. I said if blacks choose to burn down City Hall, I would supply the gas, or if they attacked Beverly Hills, I would not interfere. I don't think a word of that was ever printed. However, if they rampaged into white working class neighborhoods, the white residents are arming themselves and to kill any black coming into their space. Leave not one alive. That's what I told the press. I don't think you ever read that in the LA Times. The Jew white capitalist press never called me again through the rest of the riots. Never play by the enemy's rules. Simple reaction never wins. When the Twin Towers fell, I was quoted in the New York Times as saying the chickens have come home to roost, no matter who did it. So I'm not sitting around arguing about how it got done or who did it. All I know is about the conditions that led to it, to where it could have been anybody that was pissed off. And most people forget that they attempted to bomb the Twin Towers a few years before, and it was only because where they pulled the truck in with all the explosives couldn't park near the pillars where they need to park to with, because there was a car illegally parked there, which put that car between the truck with the explosives and the main support poles, or the Twin Towers would have came down then. So anyhow, that's the story there, and I think people forget so easy, you know. People have very poor memory about important things. Well, I see the Twin Tower truthers commemorate 9/11 with Times Square ad showing WTC-7 imploding on the infinite loop. Well, the question is not so much that, which I agree with, but how come our FBI and defense and military and all that kind of stuff did not defend us? When the FBI knew all about it, knew all about the Atta, and he was living in San Diego about 40 miles from me, they knew about it, then they had the computers full of shit up in Michigan, and the FBI didn't seize it. The military jets weren't scrambled fast in the whole bit. I think, for the most part, it was absolute total incompetence of the U.S. government or collusion. Much more than, you know, how the buildings fell and all that stuff that everybody keeps arguing about. It wouldn't have happened if we'd have had the kind of defense system that we're supposed to have, or the kind of leaders and control that we should have. That's the point. And then, of course, they make that the excuse, bumbling and screwing things up, to come up with the Homeland Security, where trillions of dollars are being blown, mostly to private, crooked contractors. So, I mean, you know, so why aren't these truthers out with battle axes storming the offices of the FBI and, you know, all these other people and the politicians, why aren't they surging into the Congress and the Senate and breaking down the doors? We're gonna commemorate it. We're never going to be able to do anything about it, but we'll commemorate it. Well, here's a letter I placed in a local newspaper. Let me see here. Dear editor, recently on 9/16, I read a letter in the Wall Street Journal from a local Winona Lake resident. It was in response to an article about a new book, The Half Has Never Been Told, which I must admit I haven't read yet. However, the gist of the letter was to attack the premise of the plantation system in the South being capitalist in nature. I was a bit shocked at such a defense of the plutocracy. If the plantation system was not a capitalist system, can you, with tongue-in-cheek, call the system free enterprise? Much of the plantation profits were deposited in northern banks. That wealth became the basis for some of the biggest capitalist corporations and bank monopoly in the North. As for me, I would have resisted even one slave ship reaching the American shores. I guess that makes me a socialist. Also, my friend Mr. Plew and I are working out feverishly on my upcoming fact-finding trip to Israel. Well, now, boys and girls, let's get back to our study of why white people never win wars. How the wars always feed debt, and that's what war is all about. Plus the killing off of millions of white people in the process, and others. There were two different causes of the war with Great Britain in 1812, and it is necessary to examine each separately. These causes were maritime rights and land hunger. The general European upheaval of 1789 to 1815, known as the French Revolution, soon developed into a war between Great Britain and Napoleon. All Europe was divided into two camps, with Great Britain and Napoleon as the leaders on their respective sides. Almost a decade before 1812, Great Britain began issuing decrees known as Orders in Council. These Orders in Council issued in the name of the king, attempting to prohibit neutral nations from shipping goods to France. In this manner, a blockade was proclaimed against France. The ships attempting to get through the lines were subject to capture and confiscation. Napoleon issued similar decrees, known as the Berlin and Milan decrees, declaring that any ships en route to Great Britain would be subject to capture, for France had also blockaded Great Britain. But as neither blockade could be fully enforced, they were both to a large degree disregarded. Both Great Britain and Napoleon were attempting to cut off each other's trade and not primarily trying to disregard the rights of neutrals. All goods attempting to run these blockades were subject to capture. The principal losers through these captures were the New England traders, but they preferred losing occasional ships to joining in a war which would involve them with their principal customer, Great Britain. I see the traders come up again, the mercantilism. Remember what I read to you about the American Civil Revolutionary War? It usually boils down to money and commerce. There had been no serious crisis since 1807, 5 years before the war was declared. Napoleon was then losing fast, and it seemed evident that it would only be a short while before the causes of friction would be over. The flagrant disregard of the rights of the neutral trade had taken place before 1807. In 1812, the solution or end of the problem was in sight. In 1810, our registered tonnage in foreign trade was 981,019 tons, which Highmark was not to reach again until 1847. Our foreign trade was not ruined, and the New England merchants who sustained the loss wanted nothing done. They were Federalists and would have preferred a war with France rather than a war with England, because they regarded Napoleon as the real cause of all the trouble. The Federalists were pro-British, while the Democrat Republicans were pro-French. Early in 1811, our minister, William Pinckney, left London, and thus the United States was cut off from knowledge of the movements in England. England was attempting to avoid war with America because such a war would naturally hurt her foreign trade and domestic prosperity. By the spring of 1812, England was ready to revoke the orders in council as soon as it could be done with dignity, but this fact was unknown to America because we had no representative there. On June the 23rd, 1812, the orders were revoked, but this was 5 days after the War of 1812 had been declared. England did not know war was declared when the orders were revoked. And the United States did not know till a good while later in the season that the orders had been revoked. Perhaps modern cable communications would have prevented this war. Another source of friction lay in the impressment of seamen and sailors. During this period, Great Britain was hard-pressed for men in her naval campaign against Napoleon. Many sailors deserted English ships and came to America because of higher wages paid by the owners of American ships. Every British warship anchored in American waters would lose a good part of its crew, who would secure positions on American ships. Great Britain demanded the return of these deserters, who would often become naturalized citizens. Great Britain, however, at the time regarded citizenship as a contract between the citizens and the government, which could not be broken without the consent of both. Disqualifying the sailor from citizenship in the United States without her consent. This European custom has now disappeared, of course, and one can change citizenship at will, as, of course, thousands of white Americans are changing citizenship every year. When the United States refused to return these men, the British ships would search American vessels on the high seas to see if any British sailors were on board. This policy of impressment waned, however, after 1805, because Napoleon had been defeated on the sea and Great Britain was not in such great need of sailors. Impressment was not made a cause of war until after the war had begun. And President Madison had learned that the orders in council had been revoked. President Madison in 1812 estimated the number of impressments at 6,057 American sailors taken off their ships, or English sailors taken off American ships. But the Massachusetts legislature appointed a committee to investigate the situation, which reported that Madison's estimate was three or four times too large. Great Britain took the position that the United States was acting as a harbor for her deserters from the British Navy and merchant ships, and that, therefore, the search was warranted as a defensive measure. The British orders of council prohibited the trading of neutral powers with France, and the British impressment of fugitive sailors from English ships were the maritime controversies which resulted in the War of 1812. You see how most of this stuff is stupid? Lack of communications and stupid people? And greed, of course. Both policies on the part of Great Britain were adopted as necessary measurements in her conflict with Napoleon. The New England Federalists were the people principally concerned in the United States, but they opposed the war. War was declared by a vote of 79-49 in the House and 19-13 in the Senate. There was open discouragement of the enlistment in New England. The governors of Massachusetts and Connecticut refused to honor President Madison's call for the militia. Henry Adams estimated that New England bankers loaned more money to Great Britain than to the United States for war purposes. Isn't that interesting? Of the 17 million in specie in the country in 1812, about 10 million was in the hands of New England Federalists. They subscribed less than $3 million to the United States war loan. Thus, strangely enough, the War of 1812 was fought in spite of the protest of those for whom it was presumably fought. But in recent years, another cause of the war, and chief cause, has been discovered. This was land hunger. The United States entered the conflict at the insistence of the South and the West, despite the opposition of the northeastern states. The inland section overruled the opposition of the maritime section. At that time, there was an ardent expansionist sentiment among the whole eastern and southern... Wait a minute here. Border, looking towards the annexation of Canada and Florida, with a vague idea of seizing all of the Spanish possessions of North America. Spain then owned Florida. Spain and Great Britain were allies against Napoleon, and a war with one was looked upon as a war with both. The belief that the United States would someday annex Canada had existed continually since the Revolution. Benjamin Franklin had advocated the buying of Canada by the United States, since we failed to take it during the Revolution. The Continental Congress made an effort to capture Canada, but our armies were repulsed. Washington had objected to leaving Canada in British hands. In 1803, Governor Morris of Pennsylvania wrote that at the time of the Constitutional Convention, he knew that all North America must at length be annexed to us. Happy indeed if the lust of dominion stopped there, unquote. This idea, however, was a vague dream until 1810. There had been friction in the Northwest between the American British and the British. The British retained trading posts in the Northwest after they had agreed to give them up by the Treaty of 1783 recognizing the independence of the United States. They were held to compensate the Tories for their property confiscated during the Revolutionary War, which had not been done. For this reason, the English, or the British, held at the Northwest Post until 1796, when they were given up by the Jay Treaty. All the Indian trouble in that section was attributed to British propaganda, which incited the Mongols against the United States. The Canadian traders made friends with the Mongols to get their trade, while the Americans were aggressively pushing them back from their land. The result was that the Mongol was more friendly to the British in Canada than to the United States. The idea of annexing Canada was intensified after 1810 because of the belief that the Indians were being turned against the United States by the British. I mean the Mongols. The idea of annexing Canada was intensified after 1810 because of the belief that the Mongols was being turned against the United States by the British. The South was almost unanimous in its demand for the annexation of Florida. Well, yeah, after they're agitated and propagandized by the newspapers and so forth. I don't think the average guy is so anxious to get involved in that kind of stuff. While the Southwest was taking a lively interest in Mexico, you mean the powers that be in the Southwest. This land hunger was making its appearance rapidly, but it was several years later that the phrase manifest destiny was to come into general use. President Madison and Secretary of State James Monroe were eager to annex Florida. Yeah, man. Thomas Jefferson was interested in annexation of Canada, Florida, and Cuba. In other words, these were what we got today, occupy and take over. Jefferson considered the acquisition of Canada only a question of marching with Florida and Cuba, easy prey from Spain. These expansionists were in favor of declaring war, while the rest of the country opposed the idea. Of course, the population. Because in most cases, we'd be killing other white people. Even in Cuba, there's a hell of a lot of white people. When Congress met in 1811, Henry Clay was elected Speaker of the House. He was leader of the war group known as the War Hawks, like Cheney was today, and all these guys. Clay was the first Speaker of the House of Representatives to recognize the great power he could exercise over legislation through his appointment of committees. You recognize most of these guys never go to war, but they can start a war. He was the first czar of the House. On the Foreign Relations Committee, Clay appointed Peter B. Porter, chairman, Calhoun of South Carolina, Grundy of Tennessee, Harper of New Hampshire, and Disha of Kentucky. All these were ardent expansionists and reliable war men. In other words, take over other people's lands. They represented the frontier section of 1812, and Clay had been chosen speaker by representatives from that section. In December 1812, while on the Foreign Relations Committee, God, they had one way back there, Porter said in discussing trouble with Great Britain, quote, "We could deprive her of her extensive provinces lying along her border to the north," unquote. Grundy and Ray, ardent expansionists from Tennessee, agreed. Yeah, let's have a war. R.M. Johnson of Kentucky, during the same session, made the statement, quote, "I shall never die contented until I see her, Great Britain's, expulsion from North America and her territories incorporated with the United States," unquote. And Harper of New Hampshire said in Congress, quote, "To me, sir, it appears that the author of nature has marked our limits in the south by the Gulf of Mexico and in the north by the regions of eternal frost," unquote. These statements were representative of the sentiments of the members of Congress from the Western section. The Federalist Party consisted chiefly of the mercantile and financial interests of the coast towns. They were solidly against expansion, which would give the economic advantage to the western section of the country. Here we go, money and profits. The winter of 1811-1812 saw a great expansion wave sweep over the west, clamoring for the annexation of Canada. Yeah, let's take it over. Instead of peacefully being racial friends, we got to take it over. Contemporary newspapers were filled with editorials demanding annexation. The cry came up from the whole frontier. Yeah, right, spurred on by newspapers. New Hampshire to Kentucky to expel the British from Canada. At a Washington's birthday dinner given at Lexington, Kentucky on February 22, 1812, the toast was proposed was Canada and our arms. Although the frontier claimed the British were inciting the Mongols against the United States, L.M. Hacker in his Western Land Hunger and the War of 1812 proves that the Mongol menace was greatly exaggerated, but that the land hunger was the real motive. Yeah, speculators. Power, money, always. Randolph of Virginia, who was opposed to the war, said in 1812 on the floor of Congress, "Ever since the report of the Committee of Foreign Relations came into the House, we've heard but one word like the whippoorwill, with but one eternal monotonous tune, Canada, Canada, Canada." You see, all these moves were not to bring the white race together of Canada or the United States. These are economic wars, as they always are. War is a racket, and it's not to benefit the white working people or white people. A few it always helps. The South and the Southwest were interested in the annexation of Florida and possibly Texas, to whom a war with Great Britain meant a war with Spain. Also, the British and Spain were then in alliance. President Madison and Secretary of State Monroe, in their eagerness to acquire Florida, had helped a General George Matthews to instigate a revolution in Florida. I wonder how many people, white people, died in that. In 1812, General Matthews took American troops to Florida with the cooperation of the War Department and also support of Governor Mitchell of Georgia. This territory was held for a year, although the Congress twice refused to authorize the president to hold it. Finally, Madison was forced to repudiate the act because of the opposition of the Federalists and the northern members of his own party. Senator Crawford of Georgia was active in his support of southern expansion. Jefferson wished to annex Cuba as a state, and Madison and Monroe were eager to annex Florida, although they were not concerned with the appropriation of Canada. The interest of the Southwest in Mexico was a spirited one. McCallum, in his book on the Aaron Burr conspiracy, points out that Burr simply attempted to do it in 1806, what the whole Southwest was dreaming of. He was conspiring against Spain and Mexico, and not against the United States, as it is usually supposed. Lands, waterways, and Mongols was the cry of men desiring to drive out Spain. In the Nashville Clarion of April 28, 1812, there appeared a long article advocating the annexation of all America, closing with a statement, quote, "Where it is written in the book of fate that the American Republic shall not stretch her limits from the capes of Chesapeake to the Nootka Sound, from the Isthmus of Panama to Hudson Bay." The paper then editorially commented the article to its readers and followed it up with a series of historical descriptive articles about Mexico. The War of 1812 continued for 2 years. Troops were raised to invade Canada, but interest in the venture was slight. In other words, the people, they didn't want to go to war with a bunch of white people. Many of the militia refused to march out of American territory, as it was understood then that the militia could not be ordered to foreign soil, which was a very good law. The expansionists could have united to declare war, but plans of expansion collapsed. The northern states opposed the annexation of Florida without Canada. The troops could never take Canada. Madison and Monroe were interested in Florida, not Canada. The British repulsed the troops from Canada. The South had no desire to acquire northern territory. The War of 1812, in fact, was a complete failure from every angle. Our troops were defeated. General Winfield Scott declared that the army officers were generally sunk in either sloth, ignorance, or habits of intemperate drinking. Swaggerers, dependents, decaying gentlemen, utterly unfit for any military purpose whatever. Muzzy, in the United States of America Through the Civil War, Volume 1, page 253, says, "The War of 1812 was a blunder. It was unnecessary, impolitic, untimely, and rash. It was primarily the work of Henry Clay. If the United States had been in any condition to fight, we should have been of great aid to Napoleon, who at that time was being defeated by the Great Britain. In the peace treaty of 1814, which brought the war to a close, the causes of the war were not mentioned." No, right. Just like they do today, you know. "The War of 1812 was a war of paradoxes. It was waged ostensibly to defense of maritime commercial interests, but the merchant states themselves threatened to secede so as to stop it. The English orders in council, the alleged cause of the war, were repealed 5 days after the war was declared, and before news of the declaration even reached England. The most important battle of the war, the Battle of New Orleans, was fought after the treaty of peace had been signed. The United States did not get any of the desired territory, was defeated in nearly every campaign, and the capital was burned by the English, with the help of the niggers." I don't know whether to laugh or cry. "The land was not gained and the rights on the sea were not granted. England never yielded the right of impressment, which remained a diplomatic controversy as late as 1842. In order to save its reputation, the administration published an exposition of the causes and character of the war, prepared by A.J. Dallas, in which it was denied that the administration had ever tried to acquire Canada. Madison was a great scholar, but not strong executive, and it was the war hawks led by Clay who forced the war upon him and the nation." That ends our study into 1812. So you see another ridiculous war where all kinds of people died, and all the powerful land speculators and everybody were trying to grab other states and expand and grab and to benefit the white race? I think not. I think not, because any time any whites got in their way, they'd step all over them. So that's it on that study, and let's see what we're going into next. The war with Mexico will begin. We'll do that tomorrow, I think. Well, I see ISIS is down in Australia. I'm sure they're probably here, too. A massive security sting operation hauled in 15 suspects and foiled a plot by the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria to hold a public beheading in Australia. Wow, man. More than 800 police officers were involved in the raids that revolved around a 22-year-old Omarjan Azari, who was charged on Thursday with preparing to commit a terrorist act. An intercepted phone call triggered the operation, prosecutors said. A senior member of ISIS was urging Azari and his group to carry out the demonstration executions, according to the Prime Minister Tony Abbott. Quote, "That's the intelligence we received," he told reporters. The exhortations... Whoop. Now why did that jump up there like that? The exhortations, quite direct exhortations, were coming from an Australian who was apparently quite senior in ISIL, Islamic State, in the Levant, an alternate name for ISIS, to networks of support back in Australia to conduct demonstration killings here in this country. So this is not just suspicion. This is intent. And that's why the police and security agencies decided to act in the way they have. Well, here's the way they should react. Once these non-white religious fanatics, similar to the Christians, start becoming active in areas outside their lands of their origin, then we must bring out the guillotine. And every time a white person living in his own land is threatened with beheading, well, then it's time to get the guillotine out and go from there. Well, I hope this doesn't blow your eardrums out. I saw my amplitude going down on my mic. And I forgot I had the preamp unplugged from the power supply, running it on battery, and the batteries are going down. So anyhow, back to our losing your head situation. Now, wouldn't it be better to have the battle of the guillotines versus the swords rather than pattern bombing the whole Mideast? Wouldn't it be so many fewer casualties? Call off the armies, call off the fighter planes, and let's just work with the guillotine, and the Islamics over there in the Middle East can use their swords. Now every time they kill and behead a white person in our countries, in Australia, United States, European countries, then we grab a half a dozen of these Islamics, radical Islamics in the United States, and behead them. Now think how many people's lives that would save when it's just simply the fight between the guillotine and the sword. And all these troops could go home and quit sending all these military weapons overseas and over there, and quit bombing all these villagers over there, and the ISIS that are coming over here, keep them from killing a bunch of more white people. Seems to make sense to me, by God. the guillotine versus the sword. And pretty soon I think both sides will get tired of that fairly fast. But it seems more humane to me for the ISIS to chop off a head now and then with a sword of people who are in their country, in their land, screwing around, and guillotining a few radical Islamics who try to screw around in the white countries of America, which I laughingly say a white country, Australia, France, Germany, England. This is actually a peace proposal to ISIS from Tom Metzger. You never know, they might take it. That's it for today. 14:05. I'll be back with you tomorrow on Freya's Day. That's Ladies' Day in the Bunker. In the meantime, if you know where we can find some guillotines or you know how to put one together, God damn it, let's get them going. I can see it now, pulling one of those guillotines in the front door of a major bank in the United States and saying, okay, give me your money or your head.
But there's been some sort of mistake.
Oh, well, we'll sort that out later.
Oh, that's a good one, eh? We'll sort it out later, after you've been crucified. Typical bloody Romans, eh?
Now you can shut up.
Or what? I'll have to give up being crucified in the afternoons.
But I don't want to be crucified.
Oh, cheer up, Brian. You know what they say. Some things in life are bad, they can really make you sad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the bad. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, this can't be forgotten. And that's the laugh and smile and dance and sing. If you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps. Just purse your lips and whistle. That's the thing. Hey, always look on the bright side of life. Very good. Always look on the light side of life. For life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your sin, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, it's your last chance anyhow. So, always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath. Life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's the laugh, a death the joke is true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep on laughing as you go. Just remember, the last laugh is on you. Hey, always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life. He says, always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the